existing in the country now. People protest and sit-in are organized. They denounce the misery, poverty. They denounce the bad condition of living. They denounce the gang violence. They denounce impunity in that country. They believe in election, but they don't. They want fair, free, honest election. They don't want to have in this situation of insecurity. If election are organized, it will be a selection.
To add to it, you said probably everything that needs to be said. It's just the resilience of this population that really wants to see democracy succeed. And today they showed clearly that they will not be participating in any selections that the core group or the international community would like to put up in their face. They are going to resist and wait for the moment, the real moment, where they see the emergence of this democracy, the development of the country, where they start thinking for them. Because, like we presented to you, you have close to 45% of the population and hunger situation. So until they see that we reach out to them, we start thinking about them, talking about them, showing them the road to education, the road to housing, you will not see a real participation of this population. They will be watching from the side and let everyone collapse unilaterally, because today the failure of Haiti is the failure of the international community and the core group that have been putting billions of dollars and not showing nothing for it, while the Lavalas movement, that when it was elected in 1990 with a very little budget, we saw the presentation and saw how we can build this country together.
We're out of time. We would like to thank the Haiti Action Committee for making this sound available to share with you. You can reach Haiti Action Committee by going to HaitiSolidarity.net. Today's show was edited by Sojourner Truth assistant producer Alicia Vargas. Thank you, Alicia. We would like to also thank today's engineer, Gary Baca. Please stay tuned for Democracy Now! Sojourner Truth will be back on the air tomorrow. And if you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives. Thank you for listening. You all, please remember to stay safe. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
Missing no no no. KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM. You don't know.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Development and Events Committee meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Welcome back to Row on the Rocks, a limited series podcast about what abortion access looked like in America before Roe was overturned. Last time on the show, I spoke with a telehealth clinician about their experience providing virtual abortion healthcare services and how this removes barriers for patients across the country living in states where abortion is seriously restricted or completely banned. Today, I'm speaking with Elisa Wells, the co-founder and co-director of Plan C, an online resource for at-home and self-managed abortions, about how virtual telehealth actually works.
I just want to help people understand that Plan C doesn't actually provide pills, and there's no such brand as a Plan C pill, even though we're somewhat becoming a household term these days. Mainly, we're marketing the idea that there is a pill that you can take when your period is late. You know, Plan A is contraception, if you had access to it. Plan B is emergency contraception, which can work, you know, just after having unprotected intercourse if you haven't had a way of using contraception. And Plan C are, you know, is a method you can take when your period is late, if Plans A and Plan B didn't work. But what we know is a lot of folks don't even know about medication abortion and that these pills exist. And then people also really don't know that you can get the pills by mail through telehealth. This has been a real innovation during the pandemic, and there are now mainstream telehealth services in about half the country. Those are the states in which it's allowed by law to happen, and there are these amazing companies that are out there: Hey Jane, Care of Them, Abortion on Demand, Pills by Post, Forward Midwifery, Choice, Just the Pill. I mean, there's all sorts of innovative providers out there that are offering really patient-centered care. Oregon and Washington both have mainstream telehealth providers. So in both states, you really don't have to go anywhere other than your computer or your phone in order to get abortion care. So that's something that we think a lot of people don't even know about. And so part of our goal is to spread the word about that. We have a guide to finding pills at our website, planzpills.org. And it is a state-by-state directory of what's available. It's all based on research. And for someone who lives in a state like Oregon or Washington, you'll go to it and you'll find some of these mainstream telehealth providers. But what if you live in a state like Texas, which is, you know, cutting off all access to care, or Oklahoma, total abortion ban there? What will you find there? Well, part of what we do is we research alternate routes of access. So how are people finding pills? And we know that there is access in all 50 states, despite politicians and bans. Aid Access, which is aidaccess.org, is a verified service that is providing telehealth medication, but the doctor sits in Amsterdam, and the pills are shipped from India. So it is a verified, trusted source of pills, and they charge $105, or they will discount the price down to zero if people can't afford it. One of the drawbacks to Aid Access is that it's, you know, not a mainstream provider, and the pills are shipped from India, so they could take 2 or 3 weeks to get to you. But often that's the same time frame that people might be looking at to get to in-clinic care, especially in states that have so few clinics and such high demand. There are also these online pharmacies that are out there, and we've done research on those as well. These are just independent businesses that ship medication abortion pills to people in all 50 states. They're a little bit more expensive. They're not physician supervised. They're not necessarily regulated in any way, but we have purchased from them. We have assayed the products that we've received just to make sure that they are real products. And we do believe it's a viable way for people to access abortion pills in the U.S., especially if they live in a state where access is limited. Another way we know people are accessing pills is by using virtual mailboxes or mail forwarding services. So for example, if you live in Alabama, which, you know, does not allow telehealth and you need care, you could go to a neighboring state or any of the states that allow telehealth abortion, and you could set up a virtual mailbox there using a service like PostScan Mail, or, you know, there's many different services. PostScan Mail is one that we have investigated and work well. And then you could do a telehealth consultation in California or in New York and give them the address in the state. You'd set up the virtual address in the same state that has the telehealth, because they're required to serve you in that state. That's what their licensing enables them to do. So they have to mail the pills to the state that they're licensed in. So you give them your virtual mailbox in that state, and then when you get the announcement from the service that you've got mail, you forward it to yourself at your home address.
Interesting.
We know people are doing that, and we provide really detailed information about how we know people are doing that. To access mainstream telehealth services in the United States, you know, these are by licensed providers with the FDA-approved product, and the pricing starts at about $150 for that. And many of them also can offer discounts for people who can't pay. So that's a real interesting way that we know people are accessing pills in the United States. And then the other way that we know people are getting pills is that they're getting them now to have on hand just in case. You know, it's not uncommon for people to find themselves pregnant when they weren't expecting to. In fact, about 50% of all pregnancies are unplanned. So why not have the medication that you would need to have it on hand in your medicine cabinet? And in much the same way that we encourage people to have Plan B or emergency contraception in your medicine cabinet, because you need to use that fairly quickly after unprotected intercourse. For abortion pills, you know, if it's going to take 2 or 3 weeks to get it from Aid Access in India, why not get it now? Have it in your medicine cabinet, and then when your period's late, there's something you can do to take immediate action.
Yes, you heard correctly earlier. Women and people who can become pregnant living in states where telehealth is banned or seriously restricted can set up virtual mailboxes in order to access abortion pills. Now, here's a little bit more about how this actually works.
We've been researching this just this last couple weeks, so it's fresh in my mind. So somebody sitting in Alabama, which does not allow telemedicine abortion, that person can go to a virtual mailbox service like Postscan Mail and apply for an address in a state that allows telemedicine. Let's use California as the example, because there are lots of telemedicine providers in California. So you go to Postscan Mail and you say, I want to get an address in California. And you look, and there are different addresses. Sometimes they're different prices. I've noticed that you could get an address on Rodeo Drive if you pay a lot of money. But really, you don't need that. You just need whatever the basic level of service is. It's probably going to be about $15. You also need to fill out some paperwork in order to set this up. And they do require a notary service, which they embed in their service, so it's all fairly seamless, but you have to pay a notary fee, so that's $20. So now we're up to $35 is the cost of this service for 1 month to rent an address. They will give you the address, and then they will send you a confirmation once all the paperwork is completed. And it's important, one of the things we learned in our testing is that it can take a couple days for this to be finalized. So you want to wait till you have the confirmation that your address is up and running and functional. And really what it is, it's just a sort of a warehousing system for mail. And they offer all sorts of different services. They can scan your mail for you, they can recycle it, they can forward it, those sorts of things. But what you would like is to have them forward a package that comes to you at that address. So once you have it confirmed, you then contact a telemedicine provider in California. And as I said, there are a lot of these. And a lot of them operate in what we say is an asynchronous way. It's not in real time. So there's no video visit that's required. It's just a form that you fill in with your medical history. They review it on the back end. A clinician reviews it. And if they have any questions, they might text with you. They might call you up, but probably unlikely because most people do qualify. So you fill out the form, you pay the fee, and again, a lot of them do offer discounts if you can't afford the entire cost, but the pricing starts at about $150 and might go up to $250 depending on the provider. And you give them your California virtual mailing address when they ask, where should I send the pills? Because they are, you know, licensed to provide the service in that state, and by law, they need to mail it to you in that state. So they're complying with the regulations that pertain to them by mailing it to your virtual mailbox. Then when, one important thing is if they ask for your billing address, you should give them your billing address in Alabama. because that's what's linked to your credit card or your payment method. And if you give them the address in California, it might not work. You know, your credit card company is not going to recognize that address. So it's fine if you have to show an ID from Alabama, or if you have to show an address from Alabama on your billing. What's really needed is just the California address for the shipping of the pills. So once you do your telehealth consultation, they'll provide you with a tracking number for your medications that are shipped from a pharmacy in the United States. And they're often shipped from a pharmacy in California, so it's a great idea to choose a virtual address in California, because then the pills are close by to the pharmacy, or your mailbox is close by to the pharmacy. So once they get the tracking, you can track when it arrives in your virtual mailbox, and your virtual mailbox also should give you a notice when you have mail. Sometimes they'll send you a picture of it, or they'll just tell you you've got mail, and they'll ask you, what do you want to do with it? Do you want us to open it? Do you want us to forward it to you? You know, how should we deal with this piece of mail in your account? And so then you can choose whether you want to send it to yourself by U.S. Postal Service, UPS, or FedEx. And there might be slightly different fees that apply to each one of those. So you can choose how much you want to pay and how fast do you need it to get to you. And you do that all online, and you pay the fee. It might be another $10 or so, or maybe $15. So now, let's see, we were at $35 before, so maybe it's $45 or $50. So this is an additional cost. You know, it's not perfect, but you have to jump through all these hoops to set this up, and you have to pay an additional cost to do it. But it is a way we know people are able to access the pills from these restricted states. So you forward it to yourself, and it should arrive within, you know, probably within about a week of when you had the online consultation with the telehealth provider in California. And then you manage the abortion. You take the pills at home. You can always still get help and advice from the telehealth providers wherever you are. It's their responsibility to send the medications to you in the state where they're licensed, but, you know, people move around, and they're totally understanding if you happen to be sitting in another place and need to ask some questions about your care.
As you might remember from previous episodes, both now and before Roe was overturned, one of the many barriers for patients trying to access abortion healthcare were the state-mandated requirements, one of them being requiring patients to set up multiple appointments before they could access the abortion healthcare procedure or simply the abortion pills. Now, with telehealth medicine, I wanted to know, did this also require setting up two appointments, especially given that in order to complete an abortion, it requires taking two sets of medication, mifepristone and misoprostol?
Yeah, that's a good question, because in times past, when the care was only available through clinics, there have been some cases where you had to appear at different appointments to get the different drugs. Mm-hmm. But that is largely not happening now, and certainly not happening through telehealth. When you do a telehealth appointment, you will receive the complete package of medications that you need in the mail altogether. So you'll get the one mifepristone pill, which is the first pill that you take. It's just swallowed like a normal medication. And then you'll receive four or sometimes eight misoprostol pills, and those are the second pills that are taken. They're taken a little bit differently. They're not just swallowed. They're dissolved against a mucous membrane, and the provider will have a recommendation as to the best way for you to take those. And those are taken 1 to 2 days after taking the misoprostol. You would get all of those together in the same package from the pharmacy as essentially a kit, and with instructions as to which ones to take when and how.
I want to get back to, I understand that this can sound like a legal question, so if you don't have an answer, that's totally understandable. But as far as you know, how does this work in terms of the bans that exist in current states? So for example, like we're talking about Alabama and other states where telehealth is banned. And what happens, as far as you know, as someone who technically has abortion pills, delivered within a state where it is legal to have access, but then forwarding it to a state and receiving it and taking that medication in a state where the pills are banned, how does that work legally? Are you still technically breaking the law, or is that method of forwarding surpassing this law somehow? Like, is there a gray area here where folks are currently able to kind of still get by legally?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's one that we get a lot. Not just about the mail forwarding option, but about accessing pills through alternate routes, you know, like aid access or online pharmacies. You know, there is a big question, can I get in trouble? And is this legal? So it's a really great question, and, you know, one that we take really seriously and trying to provide the best information about. Certainly, when you're accessing care through a mainstream telehealth service in a state that allows it, there should be no risk. You're doing everything, you know, everybody's doing everything in the way that is intended. In other states that restrict access to care, it's important to understand that most of the laws in those states pertain to providing the care and not to the people who are having the abortions themselves. There are a couple of states that specifically prohibit self-managed abortion. So in those states, perhaps going to an online pharmacy or getting pills over the border or in another way and taking them to a self-managed abortion, you know, that could be perceived as illegal. But by and large, these other services like aid access as a physician-supported telehealth service, it's just an alternate way of getting the pills and using them. There's a lot of gray area about, you know, whether anybody's doing anything wrong with that. Also, with mail forwarding, we have talked to lawyers, and people have a right to set up a mailbox and use it to forward things to themselves. And providers are complying with the laws that pertain to them. So there is a lot of gray area there, but we don't believe that anybody's doing anything wrong in that instance. Of course, this is all very new and not yet tested, so let's wait and see what happens. Even if somebody's not doing anything wrong, though, we know that people have been criminalized. And, you know, that's just, abortion is a microcosm of our larger justice system in the United States. We know that people in our country are criminalized for nothing, right? And so, and we know that the people who are disproportionately impacted by that criminalization are people of color or people who have lower incomes or youth or trans and non-binary folks. So anybody who already faces systematic oppression is more likely to be impacted by, you know, unjust criminalization. And we know that that has happened with respect to self-managed abortion. And we anticipate that it will increase as states start cracking down on abortion, you know, provision or start passing laws. A prime example of the fact that you can be criminalized even though you haven't done anything wrong in the abortion space was a case that happened a month or so ago in Texas, where a woman was alleged to have self-managed an abortion. She was arrested and put in jail. And the reproductive justice groups said, no, she's done nothing wrong and you need to release her. And they were absolutely right. Texas does not have any laws that criminalize the person who's having the abortion or say that self-managed abortion is wrong. So eventually the district attorney said, well, yes, you're right. She has done nothing wrong. There are no criminal charges. All charges are dropped. But that's just, you know, something that never should have happened. It happens because medical personnel and law enforcement personnel really have no idea what they're supposed to do if they come across somebody who has self-managed an abortion. And they might falsely believe that they need to report that person. And then they do that, and it starts this cascade of unjust criminalization against an individual. So we want to, you know, let people know about that, that it's a possibility. We do know that there have been, you know, probably several dozen people at least who have been criminalized for self-managing abortion over the past 20 years. that's probably an undercount. It's sort of hard to know exactly how many people have, but, you know, any number above zero is unacceptable. So we want people to understand that risk, but we also believe that when people consider all of the risks that are involved in being pregnant when you don't want to be, then it could be a rational decision for somebody to find an alternate source of pills and just use the pills in the privacy of their own home. In fact, we know that tens of thousands of people around the country are doing that, or have been doing that per year over the last couple of years. We do refer people to the ReProlegal helpline, which is an amazing free and confidential resource that can help people understand, you know, what are the laws in the state that I'm sitting in? How far along am I in my pregnancy? What is it that I want to do? You know, you can talk to them confidentially and they will help you assess what's the potential risk so that you can make a decision about your own care with the best information available.
Can you talk about the different barriers that folks face in terms of different communities? I know you've talked a lot about folks who are in states where telehealth is banned. I'd like to talk about ways in which, as you mentioned, Plan C and Aid Access and other organizations are providing online resources for folks and how that is very beneficial for folks in certain communities, like folks who have disabilities, the BIPOC community, folks who are part of the LGBTQ community. Can you talk about how these resources are so necessary because of the bans?
Yeah, that's a great question because it really gets at this essential issue of equity and equity and access to care. You know, the situation in the United States right now is if you have money, you know, you can get an abortion. And that's true in the restricted states now too, because it means you can travel to another state and you can take time off from work and, you know, you can make all those arrangements. But, you know, what if you don't have money or you live in a rural area or you don't really have good access to health care, or you can't take time off from work, or you don't have transportation, you can't find child care, you know, all of those types of things that we know working class people are facing, or, you know, anyone really could be facing. And also, what if you haven't been treated well by the medical system and you don't trust them to help you? We know that our, you know, systems of oppression really impact our access to medical care. And, you know, all the folks that you mentioned are at higher risk of not receiving care in the first place due to that kind of, those kinds of systemic oppression. So one of the things that we believe is that these new routes of access to pills do reduce many of these barriers and therefore, you know, increase the equity and access. So for example, a lot of these telehealth services are much less expensive than clinic-based care. So clinic-based care can be $600, $700, $800. And a lot of these telehealth services start at $150 and will also discount the service if needed. We've been working hard to connect the telehealth providers up with abortion funds that can help cover the difference. And so it really is just based on what you say you can pay. There's no forms to fill out or, you know, anything like that. You just say, well, here's what I can afford to pay, $30. And they'll say, fine, we'll cover the rest. So that's a big thing, is the lower overall cost of the telehealth services. It enables you to stay at home. So then you don't have all of these time off from work, transportation, childcare, you know, all of those types of things. And especially important if you're in a rural area, because the travel times can be quite great. And especially important if you're in a state with restrictions, because you might have to go to an entirely different state in order to get care. And then privacy is another thing that could be thought of as an equity type of issue. We know that a lot of members of the LGBTQ community have not been treated well, and also BIPOC individuals have not been treated well when they've gone to their medical providers. And so having these asynchronous care options where you really are just interacting by texting and online gives you a level of privacy that a lot of people really value. So those are a few of the ways that, you know, equity could probably be improved through these telehealth services. But we also recognize that there are likely to be equity barriers too, just inherent in telehealth. And I know that some of the research on telehealth does point out some of these things, that, you know, not everybody has broadband access, not everybody owns a smartphone. You know, you might not trust this type of system, you might prefer in-person care. So I think in an ideal world, we would want to identify, you know, what are these remaining equity barriers inherent in the system, and there are people who are researching this right now, to try and see how we can improve telehealth types of systems for abortion to erase some of those equity barriers. And then I guess the other thing that we didn't really talk about is just this idea that these laws are unjust. And there comes a point in time when you need to look at the laws that we have in our country. And I'm talking specifically about laws restricting access to abortion care, but I'm sure that there are other laws that this would also apply to. But you just have to look at the laws and reject them because they're totally unjust. And we're at that point in a lot of states in the U.S. already, and it's only going to get worse after the SCOTUS decision comes down. So I would encourage people to actively reject these unjust laws and focus on the needs of the person who needs to have the abortion. How can we help them get the care that they need affordably, safely, and without having to fear criminalization? That is really the work that we all need to do.
This is Claire Rosado with KBFM, and you're listening to Row on the Rocks, a limited series podcast about what abortion access looked like in America while Roe was still the law of the land. Music in this segment is Ragtime by Peerless, courtesy of Epidemic Sound. This is the last episode of this limited series. Special thanks to my